A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been scrolling through a subreddit called Crappy Off Brands, which is dedicated to those absurd budget supermarket products that look almost exactly like the real thing, but are just legally distinct enough to exist. You know the ones. He's asking how these companies actually get away with it. Is there an elaborate legal scheme, or are they just hoping nobody sues? Is this some kind of backhanded tribute to the originals, or do they genuinely think they'll confuse people? And he wants the canonical examples, the classics of the genre.
Oh, this is a magnificent topic. And I should say up front, I have accidentally bought these more than once. You're standing in the aisle, you're tired, the packaging has the same color blocking, same font vibe, and you get home and realize you've purchased something called Honey Nut Scooters.
Honey Nut Scooters.
Which is a real product, by the way. The cereal aisle is basically a museum of near infringement.
Of course there are. So walk me through the legal framework here. Because my instinct is that if I launched a soda called Coca-Cola, I'd get a letter within about 48 hours.
You would, and the letter would not be polite. But here's the thing. Trademark law is not a blanket prohibition on similarity. It's specifically about consumer confusion. The legal standard in the U.S., and in most common law countries, is likelihood of confusion, and that's a multi-factor test. Courts look at things like the strength of the original mark, the similarity between the marks, the similarity of the products, evidence of actual confusion, the defendant's intent, and so on.
It's not, this looks kind of like that. It's, would a reasonable person, in a hurry, grab the wrong one and not realize it?
And here's where the off-brand strategy gets clever. They're not trying to pass themselves off as the original in a way that would survive scrutiny. They're trying to signal equivalence. The message is, this is our version of that thing you like. And that's a different legal question entirely.
That's the phrase. It's like a visual shorthand for, you know what this is.
And courts have actually recognized this distinction. There's a concept called comparative advertising that's protected. There's also the idea that some marks are suggestive rather than arbitrary or fanciful. Honey Nut Cheerios describes the product, at least partially. It's not a completely made-up word like Kodak, so the protection is somewhat narrower.
The more descriptive your brand name, the harder it is to stop someone from riffing on it.
If you call your cereal Wheat Biscuits, you can't exactly stop someone else from calling theirs Wheat Bix, which brings us to one of Daniel's examples.
Which is funny.
It is, and it's also instructive. Weetabix is a UK brand, massive in Britain, Australia, parts of Africa. The name is a portmanteau of wheat and bix, which is itself a variant of biscuits, so it's already playing with descriptive language. Weetabix just drops the pretense entirely. And the packaging on these knockoffs? I pulled up some images. The color palette is identical. Navy blue, yellow wheat sheaf, same layout.
They changed one letter.
They changed one letter, and that one letter does a surprising amount of legal work, because now it's not identical. A consumer who looks at the box for more than 2 seconds will notice. The question is whether they look.
In a supermarket aisle, scanning shelves at speed, they might not.
That's where the likelihood of confusion factors come in. Courts do consider the conditions under which consumers encounter the product. But here's the counterintuitive part. A lot of these off-brands are sold in stores like Aldi or Lidl, where the entire business model is private label products that resemble national brands. The consumer walking into Aldi knows they're not in a regular supermarket. The store itself is a contextual signal.
That's an interesting defense. Nobody walks into Aldi thinking they're in a Safeway.
It's not a formal legal defense, but it's part of the practical reality of why enforcement is so uneven. The big brands have to decide, is it worth suing? Because litigation is expensive, and if you lose, you've just created precedent that weakens your mark. And if you win, you might get an injunction against one product in one jurisdiction, while 17 others pop up elsewhere.
It's whack-a-mole with legal bills.
The moles have lawyers too. Some of them are quite sophisticated. The private label industry is not a bunch of guys in a warehouse with a label printer. These are major corporations. Aldi, Lidl, Costco with Kirkland, Walmart with Great Value. They have in-house legal teams that know exactly where the line is.
They're dancing right up to it.
They're choreographing the dance. There's a whole practice area of law called trade dress that deals with this, the visual appearance of a product and its packaging. And the standard for trade dress infringement is actually higher than for word marks. You have to show that the design elements are non-functional and have acquired distinctiveness, and then you have to show likelihood of confusion on top of that.
Non-functional meaning what? That the color isn't doing a job.
If the color serves a purpose, like orange for a safety vest, you can't claim it as trade dress. For cereal boxes, the argument would be that a particular shade of yellow doesn't make the cereal taste better, so it's purely aesthetic. But the off-brand can argue that yellow signals honey flavor, generically, across the entire category.
The color itself becomes a descriptive element, not a brand marker.
And once something is generic or descriptive, it's basically in the public domain. You can't trademark honey for a cereal, or a picture of wheat, or the word crunch. The off-brands cluster around these unprotected elements and build something that looks familiar but is composed entirely of unprotectable pieces.
It's like building a house out of materials nobody owns.
That's exactly the metaphor, and sometimes the materials are even more granular. The off-brand will use a similar but not identical typeface. The layout will mirror the original, logo top left, product shot center, flavor call out bottom right, but layout is almost never protectable by itself.
Let's talk examples. Daniel asks for the canonical ones, the Wheat-Bix of the world.
Right, so the subreddit is a gold mine. You've got Dr. Pepper becoming Dr. Perky, or Dr. Perky. You've got Mountain Dew becoming Mountain Lightning, or Citrus Drop. The cereal aisle is especially rich. Frosted Flakes becomes Frosted Flakes with a different font, or Frosted Mini Spooners. Lucky Charms becomes Marshmallow Magic. Cinnamon Toast Crunch becomes Cinnamon Toasters.
That's almost elegant.
It describes exactly what the product is without using any protected words, and that's the art of it, finding the line between descriptive and infringing.
Some of them are less elegant. I've seen ones that feel shameless.
There's a famous example of Oreo becoming Oreo. Wait, no, I'm thinking of Hydrox, which was actually the original. But in the knockoff world, you get things like creme betweens or sandwich cookies in a package that's unmistakably Oreo-coated. Blue bag, white lettering, cookie visual.
Hydrox was the original? That feels like important trivia.
Hydrox came first in 1908. Oreo was the knockoff in 1912. Oreo won the market so completely that Hydrox is now the one that feels like an off-brand. It's a cautionary tale about how brand power isn't about who was first. It's about who embeds themselves in culture.
The knockoff that became the reference point. There's something almost poetic about that.
It connects to Daniel's question about whether this is a form of tribute. Because in a weird way, being knocked off is a signal that you've made it. Your product is so culturally legible that someone can gesture at it with a few visual cues and everyone knows what they mean.
Flattery through imitation, but the imitation is also a business model.
And I think the off-brands would say, with some justification, that they're providing a service. Not everyone can afford name-brand cereal. The off-brand lets you participate in the cultural experience of eating Honey Nut Cheerios without paying the brand premium. It's democratized breakfast.
That's a generous framing.
It is generous, and I'm not entirely sure I buy it myself, but it's an argument that gets made, and it's not entirely without merit. The price difference is real. Name brand cereal can be $5, $6 a box. The off-brand equivalent might be $2.50. For a family on a tight budget, that's meaningful.
Sure, but the off-brand is also not spending on R&D, or marketing, or brand building. They're free riding on someone else's investment, and then undercutting them on price.
That's the counter-argument, and it's a strong one. The name-brand company spent decades and millions of dollars building recognition and trust. The off-brand swoops in and harvests that recognition without contributing to it. It's a classic collective action problem. If everyone bought the knockoff, the original would stop existing.
There's a parasitic element.
and the law tries to balance this. You want to protect the incentive to build brands, but you also don't want to give companies perpetual monopolies over colors, shapes, and descriptive words. The system is designed to allow competition while preventing deception.
The off-brands are basically stress-testing that balance.
Every new product is an experiment in how close you can get, and the subreddit Daniel mentioned is basically the public record of those experiments.
Let's talk about some of the more audacious examples. The ones where you look at them and think, how did this get past a legal review?
There's a great one that circulates, Pops cereal, which is clearly Corn Pops, in a box that's almost pixel for pixel identical except the word corn is gone, or Fruit Rings instead of Fruit Loops, the packaging has a toucan on it. Not Toucan Sam, just
a legally distinct toucan.
A toucan with an attorney. And this is where intent comes in. In trademark cases, courts do look at whether the defendant intended to confuse consumers. If you put a toucan on your fruit-flavored ring cereal, it's hard to argue you weren't thinking about Fruit Loops.
Intent isn't required for infringement, is it?
It's not required, but it's a factor, and it can be a powerful one. If a court finds that you deliberately set out to confuse people, the burden of proof on likelihood of confusion basically flips. The court will presume confusion.
The toucan is a liability.
The toucan is a liability. But here's the thing, the toucan also works. It signals the category instantly, and the off-brand is betting that the legal risk is worth the commercial reward. By the time a lawsuit materializes, the product might have been on shelves for 2 years and made its money back 10 times over.
It's a calculated risk, not a legal loophole.
It's a calculated risk backed by a legal analysis that says, we will probably get a letter, we might get sued, but we have arguments and the damages are limited. Because here's another piece, the off-brand isn't counterfeiting. They're not putting the actual trademark on their product. Counterfeiting is criminal. What they're doing is civil, and the remedies are typically injunctive, stop doing it, plus possibly disgorgement of profits. But proving damages is hard.
Proving that someone bought Weet-Bix specifically because they thought it was Weetabix, rather than because it was cheaper.
And if the off-brand is significantly cheaper, that's actually an argument against confusion. The consumer might have seen the similarity and thought, oh, this is the cheap version of that thing I like, which is not confusion. It's a calculated consumer choice.
The difference between, I thought this was a Rolex, and I knew this wasn't a Rolex, but it looks enough like one that I felt good buying it.
That's the distinction, and it's a real one in the law. The first scenario is trademark infringement. The second is, well, it might be dilution, which is a different claim entirely. Trademark dilution is a separate cause of action, and it's available only for famous marks. The idea is that even if there's no consumer confusion, using a similar mark can erode the distinctiveness of the famous brand. If everyone starts selling Kodak cameras, eventually Kodak doesn't mean anything specific anymore. The classic example is Xerox. The company fought for decades to stop people from using it as a verb because if Xeroxing becomes generic for photocopying, they lose the trademark.
Which connects to something I've thought about before, the verb. Ification of a brand is the corporate equivalent of being knighted, but it's also an existential threat.
It's the highest compliment and the biggest danger simultaneously. Google has the same problem. Googling something is now generic and they've had to fight to maintain that, Google still refers specifically to their search engine.
For a brand like Weetabix, the existence of Weet-Bix isn't just a potential source of lost sales, it's a tiny erosion of the mark's distinctiveness. Death by 1,000 generic imitations.
That's why companies do send cease and desist letters even when the infringement case is weak. It's not just about this one product, it's about maintaining a record of enforcing the mark. If you don't enforce, you risk abandonment.
The legal system creates an incentive to be aggressive even when you're not sure you'd win.
And the off-brands know this. Some of them are designed to be just below the threshold of what a brand owner will bother to enforce. It's a kind of regulatory arbitrage.
Let's talk about the international dimension. Daniel's in Israel, you and I are here. These off-brands exist globally. Does the legal framework vary much?
It does, and that's part of why you see regional variation in how bold the knockoffs are. The UK and Australia, for instance, have a concept called passing off, which is similar to US trademark law, but with some differences. The EU has a harmonized trademark system, but in some jurisdictions, enforcement is much weaker, and the knockoffs get wilder.
I've seen photos from certain markets where the knockoff is essentially indistinguishable.
That's a different category entirely. That's not the strategic near infringement we're talking about. That's outright counterfeiting, which is a criminal enterprise. The crappy off-brand subreddit is more about the legal gray area. Products that are sold in legitimate retail chains with real corporate backing that just happen to look uncannily familiar.
What are the truly classic examples? The ones that belong in a hall of fame?
I think Dr. Thunder deserves a spot. It's Dr. Pepper, but Thunder. What does Thunder have to do with pepper soda? It's a completely arbitrary substitution that somehow works because it maintains the Dr. prefix and the rhythm of the name.
Thunder sounds like a professional wrestler.
It does, and I would watch that match. Another classic is Mountain Lightning for Mountain Dew. Lightning and dew are both nature words, so the substitution feels coherent. The packaging is green, the font is similar. You know exactly what it is.
Creme Betweens for Oreos. That one's almost apologetic. It's like they're saying, we know you know.
That's the tone a lot of these products strike, a kind of wink. We're not even trying to fool you, we're just giving you the option. It's the packaging equivalent of a shrug emoji.
There's something almost postmodern about it. The product knows it's a copy, you know it's a copy, and the transaction happens anyway.
In some cases, the copy develops its own following. People become loyal to the off-brand, not despite its knockoff status, but because of it. There's a contrarian pleasure in preferring the imitation.
Like people who insist Hydrox is better than Oreo.
There's a whole subculture of Hydrox loyalists who will tell you the cookie is crispier, the filling is less sweet, and they might be right. But they're also making a statement about authenticity and originality that's independent of the taste.
The off-brand can become a brand in its own right.
That's the ultimate irony. The thing designed to free ride on someone else's brand equity eventually accumulates its own. All these private labels, for instance, people now trust them. They don't buy Millville cereal because they think it's General Mills. They buy it because Aldi sells it and Aldi has earned their trust.
Which changes the legal analysis, doesn't it? If the off-brand has its own reputation, the argument that consumers are confused gets weaker.
And this is why the big brands sometimes struggle to win these cases. The consumer who buys fruit rounds at Aldi is not a confused consumer. They're an Aldi shopper who knows exactly what they're doing.
The store brand itself becomes a signal that overrides the similarity.
In many cases, yes. The context does the work of distinguishing. And courts are increasingly sophisticated about this. They don't just look at the two products side by side in a vacuum. They look at how they're sold, where, to whom, at what price point.
Let's go back to Daniel's question about whether this is a form of tribute. I'm skeptical of that framing, but I want to hear your take.
I think it's tribute in the same way that a cover band is tribute. It's not primarily motivated by admiration. It's motivated by market demand. But there is an element of acknowledgement. You don't knock off a product nobody's heard of. The very act of imitation says, this thing is culturally significant.
It's tribute as a byproduct. Not tribute as an intention.
The intention is commercial. The tribute is incidental, but it's still real. If you're the brand manager for Cinnamon Toast Crunch, you're not happy about cinnamon toasters, but you also recognize that cinnamon toasters wouldn't exist if your product weren't iconic.
It's the market's way of telling you you've won.
In the weirdest possible way.
What about the consumer experience side? Daniel mentioned he's accidentally bought these. I have too. Is there a taxonomy of the different levels of knockoff?
I think there is. At the low end, you've got what I'd call the budget alternative, clearly labeled with the store brand, different packaging, just the same product category. That's not really a knockoff. Then you've got the visual echo, different name, different logo, but the color palette and layout are similar enough that you do a double take. That's your Weet-Bix. Then you've got the aggressive near miss. The name is almost identical. The packaging is almost identical, and you could grab the wrong one if you're not paying attention. And then you've got outright counterfeits, which are illegal and not what we're discussing.
The aggressive near miss is where the legal action happens.
That's the battleground. And sometimes the near miss is so near that it's actually funny. There's a famous one. Morrison's, in the UK, the supermarket chain, had a product called Nutella. No, sorry, they had a product that looked like Nutella but was called something else, and the packaging was so close that Ferrero sued. Morrison's changed the packaging.
They didn't stop selling the product.
They didn't stop selling the product, they just tweaked the label. And that's often the outcome, not a ban, but a design adjustment. Move the logo, change the color, add a clearer house brand indicator, the product survives.
The legal system functions as a kind of design consultant.
An expensive, adversarial design consultant.
How big is this phenomenon? Daniel asked how many of these there are. Is there a number?
It's hard to quantify because there's no central registry of off-brand products. But the private label market in the US alone is worth over $200 billion annually. In Europe, it's even higher as a percentage of total grocery sales. In some countries like Switzerland and the UK, private label accounts for more than 40% of all packaged food sales.
40% is not a niche. That's a huge chunk of what people are eating.
Within that, the products that are explicitly inspired by national brands are a significant subset. Not all private label is a knockoff. Some of it is original. But the practice of creating a value alternative to a leading brand is the core of the business model.
It's not just food, right? This exists in pharmaceuticals, in electronics, in clothing.
Pharmaceuticals are actually a fascinating parallel because the legal framework is totally different. Generic drugs are explicitly permitted by law after patent expiry, and they're required to be bioequivalent. The branding is irrelevant. The chemical is the product. But in the over-the-counter space, you see the same knockoff dynamics. Acetaminophen in a bottle that looks suspiciously like Tylenol.
With the same color coding and everything.
And there, the question is even more fraught because a confused consumer could take the wrong medication. But the stores argue that the color coding is functional. It helps people identify the product category. Red for pain relief, blue for sleep aids, and so on.
Is that argument successful?
Some courts have accepted it. Others have said no, you can use descriptive labeling without mimicking the trade dress so closely. It's an ongoing tension.
Let's pull back and talk about what this phenomenon says about branding more broadly. These off-brands work because brands have become a kind of visual language. We read packaging the way we read words.
The fluency is almost entirely subconscious. You don't think I am now looking for the navy blue box with the yellow oval and the serif font, .find the Weetabix. Your brain does the pattern matching without conscious effort. The off-brands hijack that automatic processing.
Which is both creepy and impressive.
It's the same mechanism that makes all branding work. A brand is just a shortcut. It's a promise that reduces cognitive load. The off-brand borrows the shortcut without making the promise.
Or it makes a different promise. This will be almost as good and cost less.
And whether that promise is kept is a whole separate question. Some off-brands are comparable in quality.
I once bought off-brand toaster pastries that were essentially cardboard with jam.
Yet the Pop-Tart visual language was there. The foil wrapper, the rectangular shape, the icing stripes, the promise was made. The delivery failed.
That's the risk of the model. If the product is bad, the consumer blames not just the off-brand, but the entire category of off-brands. Whereas if Kellogg's makes a bad product, you blame Kellogg's.
That's why the successful off-brands, the Aldi model, invest heavily in quality control. They know that a bad experience with one private label product taints the whole store brand. So they're often manufactured by the same contract, manufacturers that make the name brands to similar specifications. The contract manufacturing industry is huge, and it's largely invisible to consumers. A single factory might produce cereal for General Mills, Post, and three different store brands, all on the same equipment, with slightly different formulations.
The off-brand might literally be the same product in different packaging.
The formulations can vary. Less sugar, different oil, cheaper flavorings. But the production quality is often comparable because it's the same facility, same equipment, same quality control processes.
That feels like information that should be more widely known.
It's not advertised, for obvious reasons. The name brands don't want you to know, and the store brands don't want to emphasize that they're just buying from the same suppliers. They want to build their own brand equity. But it's an open secret in the industry.
The whole edifice of brand loyalty is built partly on a manufacturing reality that makes the loyalty somewhat misplaced.
The name brand does invest in product development, in new flavors, in marketing that creates cultural meaning. The off-brand is reactive. It copies what already works. The innovation premium is real. But the manufacturing premium? That's often much smaller than people assume.
Which brings us back to the legal question. If the products are sometimes made in the same factory, the only thing being infringed is the visual identity, the trade dress, the brand itself.
That's what trademark law protects, not the product, but the signifier. The symbol that stands for the product in the consumer's mind. It's a fascinatingly abstract form of property.
It's property and meaning.
That's a beautiful way to put it. It's property in the shared understanding that this particular arrangement of colors, shapes, and words means this particular thing from this particular source.
The off-brands are saying, we can replicate the meaning without using the property.
Or we can use enough of the property to trigger the meaning without using enough to trigger the lawsuit. It's a calibration exercise.
What's the most extreme example you've come across? The one where you can't believe it exists?
There's a product that shows up on the subreddit occasionally called Not Cola, in a red can with a white swoosh. It's almost a conceptual art piece about branding. It defines itself entirely by negation. You know what this is not. Buy it anyway.
That's amazing. It's like the brand equivalent of a photo negative.
It works because cola has become so generic as a category that even the negation of the brand still signals the product. Not Cola tells you exactly what's in the can.
Although Not Cola is arguably more honest than a lot of branding.
It's radically transparent. We are not Coca-Cola. We are not Pepsi. We are a cola-flavored beverage. Here you go.
I'd buy that just for the commitment to the bit.
That's the thing. Some of these products cross over from knockoff into something creative. The subreddit Daniel mentioned isn't just a catalog of infringement. It's a gallery of strange, accidental design. Some of these products have more personality than the originals.
Because they're unburdened by brand guidelines and committee approvals.
The name brand packaging is focus grouped to death. Every element is tested and optimized. The off-brand sometimes has this chaotic energy. The name was clearly chosen in 5 minutes, the logo was done by someone's cousin, and the result is weirdly charming.
Marshmallow Magic has more whimsy than Lucky Charms, honestly.
Lucky Charms is a great name, but it's been around so long it's invisible. Marshmallow Magic sounds like something a child would name a cereal, and that's kind of delightful.
There's an aesthetic case for the off-brand, not just a legal one or an economic one.
An accidental aesthetic case. Nobody sets out to make a beloved piece of packaging design when they're creating a knockoff cereal. But sometimes it happens anyway. The constraints produce something interesting.
Constraints as creative engine. The off-brand designer has to work within a very narrow window. Close enough to signal the category, far enough to avoid litigation. And that tension can produce novel solutions.
The solutions enter the culture. People share photos of these products. They become memes. The subreddit has hundreds of thousands of subscribers. There's a whole community of people who appreciate this as a form of folk art.
Folk art is exactly right. It's vernacular design. Unintentional, unpretentious, created for purely commercial reasons, but accruing cultural meaning anyway.
That's the final irony of the whole phenomenon. The knockoffs, designed to free ride on brand equity, end up generating their own cultural value. People don't share photos of Weetabix boxes, they share photos of Weet-Bix.
The copy becomes more interesting than the original.
In a very specific, very internet-native way, yes. The copy is the content. The original is just the reference.
Daniel's prompt, at its core, is about more than just legal evasion. It's about a weird corner of culture where commerce, law, design, and humor all collide.
Where the collision produces something worth paying attention to. I mean, we've been talking about cereal boxes for 20 minutes, and I'm not bored.
Neither am I, which is either a testament to the topic or a concerning statement about us. To answer the question directly, how do they get away with it? It's a combination of careful legal calibration, the high cost of enforcement, the contextual signals of store brand retail, and the fact that likelihood of confusion is a demanding legal standard. They're not just hoping for the best, they're executing a strategy.
The strategy works because the law draws a line between confusion and evocation, and the off-brands have gotten very good at landing on the evocation side of that line.
Is it tribute? Is it deception? Rarely, in the legal sense. Is it entertaining?
Is it everywhere? If you start looking, you'll see it in every aisle.
The supermarket as museum of near infringement.
I'd visit that museum. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The world's largest hand plane a woodworking tool for flattening boards, was built in 1904 by the Stanley Rule and Lovell Company for the St. Louis World's Fair. It measured 7 feet long, weighed over 130 pounds, and used a 30-inch wide iron cutter. It was fully functional and could shave a board the width of a door in a single pass.
7 feet of plane. That's not a tool, that's a parade float.
I'm trying to imagine the workbench that thing sat on.
Here's the open question I'm left with. As private label brands get more sophisticated and more accepted, does the knockoff strategy eventually stop working? If consumers trust the store brand on its own terms, does mimicking the national brand become unnecessary or even counterproductive?
That's the direction things are heading. The most evolved private label programs, think Trader Joe's or the premium Aldi lines, don't mimic anyone, they have their own identity. The knockoff phase might be a transitional stage in the maturation of a store brand.
The visual equivalent of training wheels.
You borrow the brand language until you've built enough trust to speak in your own voice, and then you drop the mimicry and become a brand in your own right.
Which means the golden age of crappy off-brands might actually be behind us.
Or it might just be shifting to new categories, new markets, new forms of near infringement we haven't even noticed yet. The instinct to copy what works is eternal. The forms just change.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and to Daniel for the prompt, though he's probably already in the cereal aisle checking labels.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more than you'd think.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.